I'd like to bring to order the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency. We've got a pretty long agenda, and I'm going to go just a little bit out of order to take care of a couple of bills. First, we carried over two bills related to towing, and I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2824 and House Bill 3159. And I'm going to go ahead and ask Kevin Jeffries to come up. So we are open under House Bill 3159 and 2824. If you care to identify which one you're speaking about, that'd be fine.
I would like to start off by...
If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
My name is Kevin Jeffries. I'm a city councilor for the city of McMinnville. I actually worked on these towing bills in the past. In 2009, I worked for Representative Riley and became very familiar with the issues surrounding towing and the consumer protection issues related to towing. Bear with me one second. I'll get my testimony up. For a bit of background, in 2007, Senator Abel Gordley had introduced new legislation. Really, there was the first time towing was really starting to be regulated in Oregon. And she really went a long way to kind of lay the groundwork for regulating towing and protecting consumers from this practice known as predatory towing, also known as patrol towing. And in 2009, we discovered that patrol towing, predatory towing was still happening, and so Representative Riley introduced some new piece of legislation that would put some parameters around what towers can do, and in a sense, the goal was to end predatory towing. The practice of predatory towing, what it is a towing company would contract with a property manager, and they'd be allowed to patrol that lot, and if the tow truck driver felt that the vehicle was out of place or improperly parked or not authorized to park there, the tow truck driver would have the authority to tow the vehicle without any prior authorization. And the problem here that we saw in 2009 is that because the tow truck driver is paid on commission per tow, they're basically acting as the judge, the jury, and the bail bondsman in this case, and have sole discretion over whether or not something is in violation or not. So Representative Riley suggested, well, there would have to be for a property, property managers or the owner or the owner's agent would have to verify that the tow was authorized and that the vehicle was in violation. We thought that would be a really good fix. We worked on a work group that kind of helped us iron out some of the details. We had consumers there, we had the tow truck industry there, and as well as legislators were on that work group. And we said, okay, in certain cases, the tow truck driver can tow a vehicle without prior authorization. So if it blocks an entrance or an exit, blocks an emergency vehicle, blocks other parked vehicles, or violates the promptly posted parking prohibition, and in very specific cases in residential areas, think of in Portland where you have a multifamily dwelling where there's fewer parking spaces than there are units, you're going to run into parking problems. And so in those cases, if the property manager follows some procedures of handing out parking passes and things like that, then the tow truck driver could tow. Basically, what we're trying to do is eliminate any confusion, so it's very cut and dry whether or not something was in violation or not. Now, the problem we ran into, we thought that really would have solved the problem, but in 2010, Representative Riley and I continued to get complaints from consumers that they were being towed without prior authorization. I reached out to the Tow Drivers Association, and they assured me that they had done education to all their tow truck companies. And I did a quick little poll and assessment of different tow truck companies around the state, and in fact, they had been educated. They understood the law. But there were two companies in particular that were arguing that a promptly posted parking prohibition meant the same thing as regulated parking. So if it says no parking without prior authorization, or no parking without between these and these hours, or authorized parking only, that meant that the tow truck driver could then pull the vehicle. The intent of that part of the bill was that it would have to be a clearly marked prohibition 24 hours a day. So a red curb or a yellow curb or no parking sign, or this lot is closed, no parking. Not that it's regulated parking, but that it's completely prohibited, restricted at all times, to make it very black and white about when parking is allowed and when it's not. And so I think that's why I support House Bill 2824, because it does just that. It redefines what a parking prohibition is and gets rid of any of the ambiguity. And really, it restores the intent of that with that work group. And that was a consensus bill. The tow truck companies actually testified in support of that. That was the intent coming out of that work group. And it passed both the House and the Senate without any no votes. And so I support that bill, and I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to testify on it.
Thank you. I appreciate you coming forward. Do we have questions? Committee, we heard these two bills before, so we have a bit of background, and I appreciate you coming before us and giving us a little bit more background, since you were involved in a lot of that.
I appreciate it.
With that, I got one more person signed up to testify on House Bill 3159. Mr. Jeffries, did you intend on testifying on 3159 as well?
No, not this time. I'll just make the committee aware that I have submitted some amendments to Legislative Council on that, and we'll see what they look like when they came out.
Great. We'll be taking a look at them and getting them out to the stakeholders when we see those.
Thank you, Chair.
Appreciate that. Dale Horman. Dale, I don't suppose you're talking about House Bill 2824, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2824, which means we're still open on House Bill 3159.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dale Horman. I'm the Chief of Staff for the Oregon Department of Transportation. The Department of Transportation has some issues with House Bill 3159, which are outlined in my written testimony. House Bill 3159 would require the Oregon Transportation Commission to set rates for towers in certain situations. Neither the Commission nor ODOT have experience in setting rates on private businesses for consumer protection. The limited fees that the Commission and ODOT do set are primarily specific to recovering costs related to inspections or specific activities that could not be paid for with highway funds. Setting private industry rates would be a significant departure from the Department of Transportation's mission. In addition, there are no provisions in the bill for enforcement, so it is currently unknown as to who would field complaints, investigate allegations, or pursue sanctions. The cost for such rate setting would not be eligible for constitutionally dedicated highway funds. Therefore, another funding source would need to be identified for the Department of Transportation to fulfill this role. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate you pointing that out to us. We've definitely heard that previous, but I'm glad you got it on the record. It remains to be seen what will happen with that discussion. Any questions from the committee? Not seeing any. Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3159. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2929. Bob, I'll let you speak this time. Would you give us some information about House Bill 2929?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2929 requires a trustee to pay a penalty of $500 to the Attorney General for the Foreclosure Avoidance Mediation Fund if the trustee fails to provide required notice of a new sale date for foreclosed property. It establishes a penalty the trustee must pay if the trustee fails to execute and deliver the deed to the purchaser within 10 days, specify circumstances in which trustee or purchaser may void the sale, specifies that a purchaser recording of deed within 15 days of sale perfects purchaser interest in property as of 9 a.m. on date of sale, requires financial institution trust company and title insurance company trustees to maintain registered agents and offices continuously in the state, and file a statement with the Secretary of State identifying their agent and the address of the office.
Thank you. And I have signed up Tori Klein and Andrew Scholl, though they're not together, if you could come up together. And Ms. Klein, I think we'll have you go first.
Thank you, Chair Hovey, members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to talk briefly with you about HB 2929 today. I'm Tori Klein. I come from Eugene, Oregon. I'm an attorney down there. I was an attorney for a nonprofit law firm, and I help consumers with financial issues, and I also help with landlord-tenant issues. Currently, I'm the Associate General Counsel for Gorilla Capital Incorporated. Gorilla Capital is a business that buys and sells distressed property, mainly as one of our core things in Oregon. We're in three other states. We buy, remodel, and sell homes, attempting to revitalize communities in our state and increasing property values and hopefully increasing property revenue in your counties and your districts. Today, we come to support certain portions of HB 2929. We believe that these key changes that the legislation would enact in the Oregon Trustees Act would support rights of purchasers, whether large or small, consumers, and other businesses that act in the same profession as we do. Specifically, today, I wanted to talk about two or three key provisions that are in there. As you saw in the summary, it is lengthy, and it's lengthy, we'll just say that. So I'll just say three things quickly, and then I'll open it up for questions for you. The reason that I'm going to start with the express and limited rescission rights that this bill creates. In our business, we actually share a lot of the same interests as other, what I'd say, smaller consumers, because what we are is we're just a larger consumer. We happen to have really savvy people getting investors' money, so we'd be considered a larger investor who goes and buys property in this state. What this bill does, a portion of it does, is expressly limit when a trustee or a lender or beneficiary can rescind their sale or void a sale. Right now in our Oregon, in Chapter 86, we have purchasers have a right of legal possession within 10 days. We also have a mandate, a 10-day mandate for delivery of a trustee's deed, which is a different issue about mandating that to happen. But what we don't have is an express limitation whereby a beneficiary, lender, or trustee can rescind or void their sale. The reason we brought it up and we think it's an issue is that multiple times we've dealt with out-of-state trustees who take our money, keep the money, and they don't deliver a trustee's deed. And one time, in fact, months later, they rescinded a sale and kept purchaser's money. Now, luckily for us, we're a business, so we can fight it. We actually did have to fight it, and they kept our money for at least 150 days. On the eve of trial, we figured it out. Imagine that. But for other consumers, they don't have some of the power that we might as a business. What we think is with the 10-day express limitation for rescission rights, and also some clarification is, you know, if it's a mistake, we get it. Rescind it. You know, don't unilaterally do it, and do it within that 10-day window. So purchasers know when their homes are, you know, that our home will be taken back. Consumers know that they won't have to go through the foreclosure rigmarole again. With that, I'll move to the next point, unless there's specific questions on that.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Holby. I'm trying to understand this.
Yes.
Okay. I'm a commercial lender. Okay, so I have a little bit of background here.
Yeah.
But I'm missing something. So when a sale occurs, will you create the visual of how that occurs?
Yeah.
Is there not a title company involved in this?
There is.
So walk me through. If there's a title company involved, you've got an intermediary in between that should be handling the receipt of cash, the disbursement of cash, and handling the creation and the What am I missing?
Yep, Chair Holvey, Representative Smith. The issue is that at a foreclosure sale or a trustee sale, we pay on that date. We, as in my sales managers, they write a check. They give it directly to the trustee's agent.
Okay.
It's done. There's a sale. It goes directly to the bank.
Well,
they take
you're
it.
You're not getting...
So it's in a normal commercial residential sale, you have protection. You have title protection. At these sales, you don't have that protection. So purchasers, it's as is, write the check, walk away. Which is another reason that another thing in this bill addresses, you know, some concerns we have with issues with some larger banks not being able to actually even contact them and say, hey, there's an issue here. You still have $100,000, and you haven't given us a trustee's deed, and you rescinded the sale 2 months ago. We got notice by looking in the county records. You didn't even send us notice.
Because I want to make sure I understand that.
Yeah.
But the title company should be assisting to make sure everything's clean and everything's handled in a timely manner. What am I missing on that?
If we resold it, then the title company would help.
But the title company doesn't help because of the nature of this sale.
Exactly.
Hmm. Interesting. Hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And I know we there's amendments coming to this bill as well to clean up a few other pieces. But one of the requirements in this bill, I think, it requires that the trustees have a business in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. So that's one with the amendments that would remain intact. And that actually is my next point on the paper you have in front of you. Simply,
Go ahead and finish. And then
thank
we'll
you very much.
Ask you questions.
So simply stated, the banks are required to be registered with the Department of Finance, I think. There are multiple ways where any banking industry would, of course, have to be registered to do business here. Something some people run into, we've run into it, is that a trustee or a subsidiary of that bank may not be located in those same records, and their agents also sometimes are not. The reason that's an issue is that if there is a problem like the one that the express limitation seeks to resolve, it's really difficult to get a hold of people and say, hey, there's an issue. Even me as an attorney of a business, I have issues locating the right people in legal departments even to connect with and resolve it. So it was an idea that multiple people had with saying, hey, let's just make sure anyone that's doing this, even if it's a subsidiary of a bank, that they have to have a registered agent so we can get a hold of someone and try to resolve something.
Can I just ask one last question?
Very quickly.
Okay, I will. Thanks, Chair Holley. I want to make sure I understand this one last time. You folks hand over a check,
mm-hmm.
but you're not being, at that time, as the funds are being dispersed, handed over, you're not receiving a clean deed of trust.
Which, Chair Holvey, Representative Smith, we don't, it takes time for the trustees to actually draft the paperwork, and that makes sense. The reason we even say, you know, there's a 10-day window where they're supposed to give us that deed, the trustee's deed, because they have to talk to the people, the higher-ups at the bank. They have to get paperwork signed. It makes a lot of sense that we can't get it right then and there.
What if it falls through?
Who, by you know, whose fault would it be falls through the lender?
What if someone, whoever's going up that chain says, no, we're not going to agree to this?
Well,
money back?
Ideally,
they your funds for multiple days.
Ideally, this law would say you have 10 days to determine that.
Yeah.
And you have up to 10 days. And the reason we pick 10 days as what we want to support is that law already says 10 days you're the legal owner. The law already states 10 days you must deliver that deed. So by following through and aligning it with current statute that's been in, you know, I don't remember when it was amended to do it. I think that was probably in the original language. They're giving them 10 days, and even 10 days isn't defined. You know, you have 10 days calendar or business, negotiable, to get that information to the party.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I think we'll go ahead and go to Mr. Scholl, and I'm sure if this bill comes back, it needs a an amendment, and we'll probably have another opportunity to discuss this. We have a pretty full agenda today, so I want to try to keep moving.
And thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee, and I'll keep this very brief. Andrew Scholl, Oregon Department of Justice, Civil Enforcement Division. We have no position on the bill. We're neutral on the bill, but we wanted to point out to the committee that currently, as written, the department cannot enforce the provisions of the bill relating to the Attorney General's fine because there's no funding mechanism. Since the fines are being sent to the Foreclosure Avoidance Mediation Fund, we believe it would be logical to then just amend the bill to allow for that fund to be charged in terms of enforcement mechanism. So, and of course, we'd be glad to work with the committee and work with Legislative Council on those amendments.
Great. Thank you for helping out. Any other questions for this panel? Thank you very much. I'm going to, as I mentioned, we will have another public hearing on this bill going forward. So I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2929. As we have amendments coming on that bill, there will be another opportunity. So up next, we have on our agenda, looks like, let's go ahead and get a little bit of work out of the way, because I'm afraid we get into some of the next conversations, we will never get out of them. So with that, I'd like to open up a work session on House Bill 2568. Bob, give us a refresher of what House Bill 2568 is.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2568 is the bill that specifies defaults to be listed on amended notice of sale issued after release from stay on foreclosure proceedings. It authorizes the trustee, trustee's attorney, or designated agent to postpone sale for one or more periods totaling not more than 60 days or the remainder of the 180-day period allowed for postponement remaining from before the stay, whichever is greater.
Amendments on this bill? None?
None on 2568, Mr. Chair.
And fiscal revenue impact statements?
Those are in OLIS. There is no revenue impact, Mr. Chair. And apologize. I check the fiscal. No fiscal impact, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Chair Holvey, I move that House Bill 2568 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Lively moves House Bill 2568 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion from the committee? If not, Samantha, could we have a vote, please?
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Kinney-Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lively?
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Chair Holvey?
Aye. House Bill 2568 have received the votes. It is passed. And would we like to have this on the consent calendar or maybe... Let me think that we should describe this on the floor. We'll go ahead and put it on the consent calendar then. With that, I'll open up a work session on House Bill 20, or close the work session on House Bill 2568, and open up a work session on House Bill 2569. Bob, give us a brief review of that bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2569 adds law practices to the list of entities eligible for appointment as trustee of a trust deed, authorizes attorneys who are part of a trustee law practice or who share law practice with trustee attorney to sign documents with certain disclosure. There is a -1 amendment available in OLIS, which specifies the statement attorney signing on behalf of trustee must make on a signed document and clarifies the definition of law practice.
Representative Lively.
Chair Hovey, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment to Bill 2569 dated March 5th, 2013.
Representative Lively moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2569 dated 3513. Discussion on the adoption of the amendment. Any opposition to the adoption of the amendment? Amendment is adopted.
Chair Hovey, I move House Bill
2569
as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Lively moves House Bill 2569 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none. Samantha?
Representative Dorey?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Kniegeier?
Aye.
Representative
Smith? Aye. Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Vigna Peterson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lively?
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 2569 having received the votes, it is passed to the floor. Should this one be discussed on the floor? Vice Chair Richardson, what do you think about this?
He's looking at you.
I don't think that anybody's going to care.
Consent calendar for House Bill 2569. I'll close it. If there's no objections to the consent calendar, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2569.
Sorry. Thank you. Thank you.
That was the open a work session on House Bill 2346.
Most people carry it. No documents tied to anything.
Bob, give us a review of House Bill 2346.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2346 allows insurer of portable electronics to provide required notice to enrolled customer via electronic means if, after notice that provision of electronic mail address constitutes consent to receive notice electronically, the enrolled customer provides an electronic mail address. There is a Dash 2 amendment proposed, which subjects correspondence other than notice to provisions of the bill and makes technical language changes.
Mr. Miller, would you like to come up and talk to us about the Dash 2 amendment, please?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of Assurian, and I hope no one cares about this bill either. If you recall from the last hearing, the bill just simply aligns the notification portion of the electronics portable electronics statute with the rest of the property casualty insurance statutes. And so Dash 2 needed to be cleaned up, and we did that specifically adding ORS 84070, which then answers a couple questions that were asked last hearing by Representative Thatcher and Vice Chair Lively dealing with the Uniform Electronic Act. And that simply states that, insurance companies are required to send the notice to the consumer with the request of a return receipt. And so once the return receipt is either accepted or not, and again, if it's not, I think it was Representative Thatcher who mentioned someone changes an email address or it bounces back, it reverts back to the notice, the mail notice. And so this bill just, again, lines that up with the other property casualty statutes. And it's a Dash 2 amendment.
And so you're not anticipating needing more amendments to this bill, I assume?
No, Mr. Chairman. After the last hearing, the Insurance Division and the industry signed off.
Great. Any questions? Thank you.
Chair Hovey, I move the Dash 2 amendments dated March 5th, 2013 for approval.
Representative Lively moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill be adopted to House Bill 2346. And those amendments are dated 3/5/2013. Discussion about that? Any objection? Seeing none, the Dash 2 amendments are adopted.
Chair Hovey, I move House Bill 2346 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Lively moves House Bill 2346 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Bob, we have fiscal and revenue impact statements in order on this?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. With the Dash 2 amendment, there is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact to House Bill 2346.
Thank you. Samantha, can we have a vote, please?
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Kittygeyer?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Davis Gleason?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lively?
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 2346, having received the votes, is passed to the floor. And Representative Thatcher, would you like to carry this one on the floor? I think somebody cares about this bill.
Absolutely love to, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you.
I care.
So Thatcher will carry. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2346. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2936. Bob, give us a brief summary of House Bill 2936. You love it when I jump around, don't you?
Want to ride, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2936 prohibits a financial institution from disclosing personal financial information to unaffiliated party without first receiving explicit consent from consumer to whom financial information relates. Makes violation unlawful trade practice, defines personal financial information, specifies exempt types of disclosures, requires the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services to specify the form, means, and contents of the required consent, and becomes operative January 1, 2014. And there is an emergency clause on the measure, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I have two people signed up, Becky Strauss and Tim Martinez. Good afternoon. I don't see Tim. He'll probably show up any second. So good afternoon. If you introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. Chair Holby, members of the committee, Becky Strauss. On behalf of the ACLU of Oregon, thank you for the opportunity to come and provide comments in regard to House Bill 2936. As I read it, the bill would provide better protect the privacy of personal financial information by creating a presumption that the information may not be sold or otherwise disclosed unless permitted by law. We are in support of this bill. In the course of a financial transaction, there is a great deal of private information that is collected about a person, and we believe that that information is worthy of protection. At the federal level, there are several laws, probably more than the ones I'm going to list right now, that do address issues of disclosure of financial information. The ones I have looked over at a very surface level are the Fair Credit Reporting Act, the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, and the Right to Financial Privacy Act. In different iterations, these bills allow that in certain circumstances, consumers may receive notice of a pending disclosure to another party of information about their finances or their personal information. And then in other circumstances, consumers would have the right to opt out of their information being provided or disclosed beyond its original purpose. I think that, in our view, these federal laws are the floor and not the ceiling of financial privacy law. In regard to what states can do, I think that we have the opportunity to go further, and we certainly commend the chair for making a proposal that Oregon do so and put in place stronger protections here in Oregon. Specifically, we believe that what House Bill 2936 would do is shift the presumption so that it's an opt-in system for consumers to consent to disclosure of their information as opposed to an opt-out system. And that's the primary value of this bill. Opting out can be cumbersome and confusing for a consumer. Effectively, in order to opt out, the consumer has to contact every single entity that might have some of their financial information and do so in a timely manner. Oftentimes it involves tracking down your account number or postage if you're not doing it online. Again, it makes it more difficult for someone to express their intent that their information not be shared rather than the presumption that it is not shared unless they expressly opt in to do so. And I'll just close by saying that in general, the ACLU has always believed that information we provide for a specific purpose, whether it be in this context of financial information, whether it be employment, whether it be healthcare, any other type of service or benefit, that information should only be used for that initial purpose for which it was provided, unless that consumer, in this case, provides express consent to share it in other places. So we think this is a good bill. Look forward to working on it this session or in future sessions if we want to make some changes, and thank you for the opportunity to weigh in.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Questions for Ms. Strauss? Not seeing any. I know that
go ahead.
Tim Martinez has signed up. I was going to speak for him, but he showed up, so we'll let him come ahead and come up. Oh, Becky, you may want to stay. There might have been a question. Representative Thatcher, do you want to go ahead and ask that question now?
Yeah, I'm just thinking about all the information that is already out there and broadcast to, I don't know, all these places that I know is out there on myself, for instance. And maybe I'm different because I'm a public official, but okay, just set that aside. Let's pretend I'm not a public official. How does that help us put the GED back in the bottle, so to speak?
Chair Holvey, Representative Thatcher, I think that there's certainly a distinction, and I'm not sure what specific information you're thinking about, but there's obviously a distinction between information that is otherwise public and information like account numbers, financial records, account balances, things like that, that shouldn't be public, I think even for public officials, unless in their official capacity in some way. And so it is very concerning. Oftentimes the information gets out or it gets shared with unauthorized parties, and there really is no way to put the genie back in the bottle, if you will. And so part of it is putting in some of the protections on the front end so that the information is not shared where it shouldn't be.
So I guess a follow-up. So what specific things are you talking about? Are you just talking about not necessarily what we spent on our house or what we paid for X good? You're talking about account numbers and things like that can be stolen, basically, and so people can steal your identity. Is that more of what you're talking about?
Chair Holvey, Representative Thatcher, there are some pieces of information that may be involved in a financial transaction that would be subject to public record. I think, and I don't have the bill in front of me, but I believe that the bill here, thank you, does provide a definition of what some of that private financial information would be. But in terms of your touching on the risks of identity theft, that's certainly one issue. But I think from our perspective, there's just a fundamental value to privacy in of itself. And so information that is not, you provide your account number to open your bank account, or your account balance, or what you're spending your money on at the grocery store, is only meant for that purpose, and you provide your information for that purpose, and so when it's shared out to other entities, that's where it becomes concerning.
Thank you. And I certainly had thought about this in terms of a different impact this bill could have, with just judging from the opt-in as opposed to the opt-out scenario, because I've had constituents tell me that they feel something like this would reduce the junk mail in their mailbox. Any thoughts on that? Oh, never mind. Mr. Martinez, you're up.
Thank you.
I was going to speak for you and just recognize that you signed up in opposition. So if you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association and the Independent Community Banks of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill and for the opportunity to meet with you a couple times to discuss it. We are opposed to the bill in its current form. Primarily because we believe that the consumer is protected already three different ways. You know, bankers are certainly belts and suspenders type individuals. It's that type of a profession and industry. But, Graham Leach Bliley addressed this issue. The Fair Credit Reporting Act addresses this issue. And Reg P, the Privacy of Consumer Financial Info, all addresses this issue. So there are national standards. I provided to the chair, and I apologize, I can get it to your committee assistant for the rest of the committee. some of the United States Code on this particular issue. I'd like to read just one piece, if I could, from that. This says, in general, a financial institution may not disclose non-public personal information to a non-affiliated third party unless such financial institution clearly and conspicuously discloses to the consumer in writing or in electronic form or other form permitted by the regulations prescribed under Section 6804 of this title that such information may be disclosed to such third party. In addition, the consumer is given the opportunity before the time that such information is initially disclosed to direct that such information not be disclosed to such third party. So, I think I understand the proponents and the direction they're trying to go on this, but we would be literally going against what the rest of the country does and would set us apart. The folks that's going to hurt the most in my association are going to be the community banks, because they're going to have to do it one way for the feds and one way for the state. When the regulators come in, there's going to be all sorts of issues and making sure it's done properly, so the compliance costs are going to go up. And the questions that we would have just in general about the bill, and I apologize to the proponent for not being in the room when she testified, but let's just look at buying or selling a home. You have to provide information to the title company, you have to provide information to the county clerk, you have to provide information to the realtor, and to whatever the other party is, the buyer or the seller, whatever side it is. We believe that this would be very difficult under this bill if, for whatever reason, the consumer said, I'm not going to opt in. When you write a check, when does the bank or the other financial institution become liable for that? If somebody's looking over my shoulder where I'm writing my check and getting information off of that, am I going to be liable, or is that the consumer's issue? When you open up an account with us or other financial institutions, can we print your checks? I mean, again, if you're unwilling to sign as an opt-in, or for whatever reason the bank or other institution does not get that signature signed, you can't order checks, you can't order loan coupons. So there's a lot of things in here that we believe have been addressed at the federal level. Would be happy to continue the dialogue with the chair and with the proponents. Again, there is a lot of federal regs in this area, and Congress has acted appropriately. I would just say that, the institutions that I represent are very concerned about personal privacy. I was proud to be part of the work group a few years ago that included everybody, Osberg, lenders, lawyers, on our privacy laws and our identity theft. And you were part of that work group as well, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chairman. Mm-hmm. And, I use that around the country when I talk to my peers, because we have a great law on the books dealing with identity theft. So, again, I'd be happy to talk to anybody individually about what's in the federal regs already. I will make copies for the committee administrator and assistant to share. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Do you have that electronically, those copies? Because it's pretty thick book.
I know. I've now printed out three times. That's one of the reasons I was late, was making my printer sure had enough paper. But, yes, I will do that electronically. Absolutely.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate your testimony, committee. I think we probably don't need a lot of discussion about this one. I think it's a pretty short and simple.
Yes.
Representative Richardson.
I was wondering if we might get a response. I was not aware that the provisions of this bill were so broad, and so do you agree that this could interfere with the ability of a bank to order checks and other things that banks do normally?
Chair Holvey, Representative Richardson, just to be clear, the ACLU is in support of this bill, but we did not draft it or bring it forward. But I'm happy to respond to some of the things that have been mentioned. I think that Mr. Martinez was reading from the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, which focuses on what financial institutions can do with the information that they have. My understanding is that this bill would reach beyond financial institutions, but to just entities in control of personal financial information. So to that extent, it's a little beyond the federal law. Another distinction that's different than the federal law is an issue that was brought to light is the opt-in, opt-out question. So the federal laws are all of the, I know of two of the ones that were listed are an opt-out situation. So what would be different here is the opt-in, and certainly the point was raised about Oregon doing something different than some of the other states are doing. In regard to the point about writing checks and such, I do know that in this bill there are several exceptions to the disclosure, so I don't know enough about the bill to know whether that would fall under the exception. I believe there's an exception for the financial institution conducting its business. And I think the distinction that I would highlight again is moving beyond the intent for which the information was initially collected to then share with unaffiliated parties, share or sell, for that matter, the information without the consent of the consumer.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Thank you very much, and I'm sure, you know, we'll have a conversation if and when this should move forward. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2936, and I'm going to open concurrently House Bill 2525 and House Bill 3160. Bob, can you give us a little bit of information about those two bills, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2525 establishes a private right of action for aggrieved party against person whose act or omission violates the Insurance Practices Act, limits filing of action to 2 years after discovery of the act or omission, authorizes action as a class action, allows a court to award reasonable attorney fees and costs to the prevailing party, but only to defendant if reasonable grounds for suit did not exist, repeal certain existing provisions related to private actions and attorney fees under the Insurance Practices Act, and makes a violation of the Insurance Practices Act an unlawful trade practice subject to action by the Attorney General.
Thank you. And we've got a very large list of people signed up, and some people have signed up for both bills, so that's why we have this hearing open, both bills open at the same time, so you can speak to both and not expect to be called back to speak on the other one. And we do have a pretty long list, so we're going to probably figure out how, you know, trying to limit the time at some point, since we have just about an hour left. So with that, I'm going to call up Charlie Merton and Angela Martin, please.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Charles Merton. I'm a farmer and woodlot owner out of North Plains, Oregon. I recently retired from the practice of law after 50 years, and I've been asked to speak to you about a narrow issue involving the insurance industry, and that is how it came to be that the insurance industry was excluded from Oregon's Unlawful Trade Practices Act, which was enacted in 1971. I had a career in legal aid services in Multnomah County from 1967 into mid part of 1971. In 1967, Neil Goldschmidt was a legal aid lawyer in that program. And he got a hold of some consumer legislation from other states, submitted bills to be introduced here, but because he was interested in running for the City Council of Portland at that time, there wasn't much follow-up on lobbying for the bill. Legal aid was allowed to lobby in those years. It wasn't prohibited until Richard Nixon became President of the United States. Building on that experience, in 1970, I assigned two of the lawyers who worked for Legal Aid to draft legislation in coordination with the Attorney General at that time of the state of Oregon, which was Lee Johnson, a Republican. The Attorney General staff and my staff worked together. They developed several bills, consumer protection bills, including the 1971 version of the Deceptive Trade Practice, Unlawful Trade Practices Act. Hearings were held. In those hearings, there was not much opposition, frankly. Except for a surprise, and the surprise came from lobbyists who appeared on behalf of the banking industry and the insurance industry. Those lobbyists pointed out that Legal Aid had not cited one instance where a Legal Aid client had been injured by some practice of their industry. And then made a administrative burden argument that this duplicates what the federal government does, federal banking laws do, and oversight, and duplicates the what the then Oregon insurance commissioner did in scrutinizing what their rates and so forth. There's some question as to the efficacy of all of those regulatory bodies, and at that time and even today, as to what they do about consumer protection. It's more rates and worldwide financial concerns as distinguished from protection of the individual consumer. In opposition, the banking industry said, the feds regulate us, this is administrative burden. The insurance company said, the state of Oregon regulates us, it's an administrative burden. Going forward, as a result of that opposition, the legislature exempted both industries. Now, 4 years ago, as I understand it, the banking industry lost their exemption. We are now in a situation where only the insurance industry is exempt. There are some interesting statistics about the insurance industry. One is that in the state of Oregon, there are some 3,000 plus insurance companies that do business here. But only 1.5% of those businesses are headquartered here in this state. Those that are headquartered here, if they do business outside of this state, they have to comply with the equivalent of Oregon's Unfair Trade Practices Act, enacted by other states. Here is a list. There are 35 states that do not exclude insurance companies from coverage of their Deceptive Trade Practices Act. Those states include Arizona, Texas, Utah, Wyoming, New Mexico, Nevada.
Mr. Merton, you don't have to name all the states for us right now.
I want to point out those are not particularly liberal states.
If you can summarize your conclusion, right. Because we have a lot of people to, if you can make your good points.
Here's my conclusion.
Okay, thank you.
And I'll read it. By the way, there's an error. I made a typo about Neil Goldschmidt what year he was doing what he did.
A lot of people have, and so.
I agree. It was in 1967, not 69. All right, here's my conclusion. With the modern attitude of mega corporations that exist today, insurance policyholders have become just a number or a premium to collect. Customers do not have much contact with their agents. The insurance companies always take the position of the agent commits fraud or something like that. Say, well, he's on a frolic on his own, and besides, he's an independent contractor, not our employee. For Oregon, there's no governmental body here that has either the money or the bodies needed to collect and process any significant number of abuses or to provide legal recourse to Oregonians injured by deceptive practices. Our Act is enforced by private attorneys representing consumers. Our Act applies to all businesses, all companies, all professionals, and all service providers except for the insurance industry. The times have changed, and so should our Act.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Martin.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, my name is Angela Martin, representing Economic Fairness Oregon, testifying today in support of House Bill 3160 and House Bill 2525. And I want to lead off my testimony by acknowledging how important a well-functioning insurance market is to the financial well-being of our families and businesses. I'd say that insurance affects the public interest and plays such a vital role as a gatekeeper of the middle class. An individual can choose to buy a TV, buy a new car, but the average American simply has no choice about whether or not to purchase insurance. The state compels us to buy insurance if we want to drive. No bank is going to lend us money unless we buy homeowners insurance. And certainly prudence dictates that we purchase insurance to protect the financial interests of our families and our businesses. But by all measures, insurance being necessary, an important product, It's a travesty of consumer protection that so few protections exist against the failure of an insurance company to deliver on the promises contained in the policies that people purchase and pay for. The auto dealer that sells us the car, the banker that lends us money for that house, they're all subject to Oregon's most important consumer protection statute. And as we've just heard, it's only the insurance industry that is exempt from that. Now, that's certainly not to suggest that insurance is under-regulated or lacks regulation. No doubt you're going to hear today about the mountain of regulations that insurance companies face. It's true, and it's also very necessary given that insurance is selling to a largely captive audience and the just that so much is at stake for the people and the businesses that rely on those policies. Under state regulation, there are laws guiding the development and the sale of insurance products, the forms. There are regulations aimed at ensuring that every company has the ability to pay those claims. However, the laws aimed at making sure the insurance companies do pay those claims and do so in a fair and timely manner lack the enforcement necessary for individual consumers to make sure that they're fully protected. And that's simply because nowhere in those hundreds and hundreds of pages of regulations are individual consumers given the right and the ability to take their case before a judge. And that's simply the focus that we're looking at with House Bill 3160 and 2525. Proponents aren't attempting to add new or duplicative requirements about how insurers run their day-to-day business or draft their forms. We're simply working to make sure that the laws that do exist are faithfully enforced and that policyholders are protected. Under our current law, you'll probably also hear about the ability of consumers to complain. And in Oregon, thousands of consumers file complaints with both our insurance division and the Department of Justice. And I trust that the agency staff that answer those calls do an expert job at logging or redirecting or settling those complaints as they're able. But I'm here because the agency complaint process alone simply is not sufficient. By its own admission, the insurance division does not act as a consumer's legal counsel. And consumers who contact the Department of Justice are redirected because the Attorney General lacks the authority to pursue insurance industry misdeeds and violations. Now, some consumers hire an attorney and fight for their legal rights in a court.
And Ms. Martin, could you go ahead and figure out how to conclude here, because I want to get through as much testimony as we can in committee. We're going to hold questions on these two bills. We will have opportunities in the future to get your questions, so write them down and we'll hold on to them.
The conclusion is simple. I simply want to point out that many heavily regulated industries, like I mentioned, banks, utility companies, food manufacturers, are all subject to Oregon's UTPA, and I certainly hope that you'll vote to add insurance to that list. Thank you.
Thank you, and I apologize for interrupting your testimony. I just want to try to make sure we're fair and give everybody an opportunity. Up next, we have Steve Patterson, Karen Sopworth, and Ed Davis.
Chair Holby, members, my name is Steve Patterson. I'm from McMinnville. I work for Oregon Mutual Insurance Company. After Mr. Merton's testimony, I think he ought to trade up to Oregon Mutual because we're a local company headquartered in Oregon up in McMinnville. We serve five western states from that location primarily. And I would say in relation to the last testimony, you know, no business succeeds or succeeds long cheating their customers. So we feel we're a consumer organization as well because we need to make our customers whole because that's how we get more customers. Well, thank you for this opportunity today. I'm a member of the Chamber of Commerce, and I can tell you with members of our chamber, I'm the recent past chair in McMinnville, insurance costs is a big deal. And we're here in opposition in part because this is going to drive insurance costs. We oppose this bill because there's a track record of what this kind of legislation does. And California's experienced it. Washington's in the middle of the experience of it. And having worked in California in the late 90s, if I can try to quickly summarize for you, the wheel of history. Bad faith didn't generate out of a legislative body in California. It was pled in a lawsuit and given by a court. And they lived with it from 1979 to 1988 when it was overturned by the California Supreme Court. And the court, you know, getting rid of that law, which was a third-party bad faith bill, allowed a second lawsuit, was in part because of what it did to the insurance marketplace in California. Costs went up, more claims ended with attorney representation, and premiums went up for consumers, well over 50%. A study done by RAND on that, after the fact, looked and said the economic damage claims presented to insurers rose 270% during the time the Royal Globe Law, which is the case that was in California, was in effect in California. In getting rid of it, the California Supreme Court made comment in their opinion that the leverage on claim settlement had been tilted and that claims were being made that were too high and that insurance companies were settling too many claims as a result of the fact that they either risk bad faith punitive damages or they'd settle for a few more dollars. So costs went up and the consumers paid. After that law, in the next several years to 1992 and then 1997, they measured on the path trajectory that they were on, and rates came down by 45% by 1992 and by 65% by 1997. In 1999, the California legislature decided that the industry and the marketplace was, in good enough shape again. They passed the third-party bad faith law. And the result was it went to the public, and voters in California who'd already lived under it rejected it 3-1. So third-party bad faith has been tried and failed because of its effect on consumers, not insurance companies. It puts price pressure on us to be competitive. And if we're going to be able to continue to provide insurance, the rates are going to reflect what we're paying out in claims. I would say adjustment costs. Even if you didn't pay a claim, there's adjustment costs involved. Bad faith laws make that rise. The new set of laws, and some of it is captured in these bills, is sort of a Washington State-type bad faith with the UTPA. And although, you know, extensive studies may not have been done on it as they were on the California bad faith bill, we have looked at it from an industry standpoint. And I can talk for Oregon Mutual, who sells insurance in Washington.
And if you can think about making your conclusion so other people can speak.
Yes, sir, I will. In Washington, our average paid claim between 2008, the first year it was in 2010, went up 27%. Our loss expense, so buying lawyers, doing investigation, trying to take care of that, went up by 47%. And has leveled off a little since then, but that's a pretty big increase, puts pressure on prices. Lastly, I'd say that type of bill changes the way we're regulated. You have the absolute right to consider and do that, but it's different. And I worry about given the legal scheme, that the legislative scheme and the way we're regulated now, you drop on top of it a new set of rules and laws given some of our ORCPs, and it's likely that we're going to have a lot of unintended consequences. At Oregon Mutual, we don't think this is good for our consumers, and so I'm here on behalf of the company to oppose it. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Karen Southworth Weaver, last name Weaver. I am the professor of insurance law at the University of Washington Law School. I'm admitted in Oregon and practice in Oregon as well as Washington and Alaska. And the focus of my practice is insurance coverage and bad faith. So other people defend the auto accidents. I work with the claims of consumers against insurance companies. And in my capacity as in my academic capacity, I have a real interest in laws working, because as I tell my students, insurance is actually, it's actually a really radical social contract. If you think back to pioneer times, if someone's barn burned down, the neighbors came and there was a barn raising. Everyone helped each other. That's what insurance does now in a more complex society where we don't know our neighbors. We all pay money into a pool, and when somebody's house burns down, that person gets to go into the pool and have their house rebuilt. I mean, that's the general concept. One of the serious problems with both House Bill 2525 and 3160 is that both of these, in trying to shift, I'll call it enforcement mechanisms, to private lawsuits, you are adding cost. There has to be a bigger pool. It's like everyone knows the problem with health insurance. The real problem, the real reason it's so expensive, is that health costs are too high in the health industry. And what these bills do is they are going to make the costs of insurance transactions skyrocket, with attorney's fees payable to the plaintiff attorneys and payable to the carrier's attorneys. So I would be one of the beneficiaries receiving that money. But that is not money that then helps the average consumer. It's your constituents who have to pay that money in. It's not the insurance company paying it. It's the people of the state of Oregon. Sometimes insurance isn't the right mechanism for sharing. I know there's an autism issue, and you know there are times when the state has to step in and be the source of funds. Whereas in insurance contracts, certain things can be done commercially, and the constituents can pay for that. But the cost on this is going to be very high. Another problem with this legislation, in trying to fit it to the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, you have wording saying a person that suffers an ascertainable loss. You aren't even limiting these enforcement abilities to people who purchase the insurance. You aren't limiting it to the insureds. You're saying some third party can come and sue the insurance company and claim you have to pay me more because your insured did this. Not only does that make cost skyrockets, it puts the insurance company in a conflict of interest, which was one of the big problems in California. Mr. Patterson didn't mention, but in California, the problems with this Royal Globe type problem with third parties being able to bring actions against insurers, it included a substantial insurance fraud, mostly by attorneys, frankly, churning files, and there were federal prosecutions and people in federal prison. So it's really not something you want to put into Oregon laws.
And if you could make your conclusion, please.
I will do so. My one last point is that the insurance commissioner actually does have substantial regulatory power, and there is private regulatory power in lawsuits already. In many, there are breach of contract actions, there are statutes that give attorneys fees for a successful action, there are claims for breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. So there are remedies available. If one tries to shift the enforcement mechanism for insurance trade practices to individuals, those judges and those plaintiff attorneys aren't going to understand the entire scheme and all of the other regulatory requirements that an insurer has to meet. The one other just factual piece of information that I'll read to you is relates to these unfair trade practices that are existing in Oregon statutes already without a private right of enforcement. They were based on the National Association of Insurance Commissioners model legislation suggesting these. And here's what the National Association of Insurance Commissioners says about those very rules. The various provisions of this regulation are intended to define procedures and practices which constitute unfair claims practices. Nothing herein shall be construed to create nor imply a private cause of action for violation of this regulation. Any jurisdiction which may choose to provide for a private cause of action should consider a different statutory scheme. This regulation is inherently inconsistent with a private cause of action. So that is what the insurance commissioner drafters said about the very standards that already do exist in Oregon law, which the plaintiff's bar is now trying to make themselves the enforcers of, and the very drafters said, no, this was never meant for private enforcement. Thank you.
Thank you. Could you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Yes, Chair Hovey, thank you. My name is Edward Davis. I'm a senior account executive with MAPS Insurance here in Salem. I'm speaking today on behalf of the Independent Insurance Agents and Brokers of Oregon. I'm the a director and legislative chair, and the Professional Insurance Agents of Oregon, Idaho, of which I'm a member. Our two organizations represent over 5,000 individual licensed insurance producers across the state. We are independent small business owners in your community. We coach the Little League teams and belong to the Red Cross and the Rotary and the service clubs. As small business owners, we are very concerned about the potential impact that increased litigation on us would do to our costs and our ability to maintain our employment and service to our clients. We as commissioned salespeople don't have the ability to raise our prices. So the two-edged sword is that since we are paid on commission, if prices go up by 50%, then we make more money. So we're speaking on behalf of both of our self-interest here and on behalf of our clients whose prices would be increased by this regulation. We've found in talking to our peers across the country that where there has been dual regulation by both the insurance commissioners and the attorney general offices, there's been a great deal of confusion on the part of our peers in terms of how they're supposed to react. The attorney general offices generally do not have the education or the understanding of the various complexities of insurance statutes and are not really equipped to deal with that. We also are concerned about the duplication of cost, the increase of litigation in an already overburdened court system. Before he retired, former Chief Justice Paul DeMunis, a good friend, spoke on many occasions about the difficulty of the court systems in terms of dealing with the existing number of cases that are there and the need for additional funding in court cases. You are tasked with trying to create a balanced budget for the state and look for ways to reduce costs. This is not one that's going to help you accomplish that. So with that, I'd like to echo the fact that if there's no individual right of action, I'm certain our errors and omissions carriers would significantly lower our existing premium rates because they certainly face those, as do insurance carriers all every day in terms of litigation on the contract claims that have been mentioned.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that. Up next, I have Fred Millard, Jason Skelton. Go ahead. If you got an imperative question, we will have another public hearing on this, but if you got something that's pertinent,
if the
go ahead.
Panel is not here and we're not ahead. Able go. To ask questions.
Go ahead.
Okay,
go
thank
ahead.
You.
Try to keep it brief if you can.
Okay, two questions. One, is it Mr. Patterson?
Yes, sir.
Okay. What five states do you insure in?
Oregon, Washington, California, Idaho, and Nevada.
Okay. The question is that you said that if this were to go through, that rates would substantially be increased. And so my question is, how does Oregon's current rates compare with Washington and Idaho, other states? I mean, we ought to be substantially less than their rates currently. Is that correct?
In fact, I think we are. And I think I was at a recent hearing before the holidays with the insurance department where they opined on the state of the rates, insurance rates in Oregon, and they are substantially less than, say, Washington. Our experience is, I mean, each state has their own, but our rates have increased in Washington as a result of this, because our experience has increased. So, you know, it's a blanket statement that, yeah, rates are going to go up. I'm suggesting that experience says costs will go up and rates will follow costs.
I guess my question is, it's easy to say, and you also said rates are going to skyrocket. Well, that means that our rates should be less than skyrocketing when, you know, I had no indication that our rates were substantially less than our adjoining states. But if that is the case, that would be good. And I have one other question, and that is, if this is about the ability to bring an action for wrongdoing, why would there be a kind of this rush to the courts? I mean, is a wrongdoing going on right now that plaintiffs don't have the option to proceed with? Or is there a fear in the industry that it's going to be disclosed? I mean, why would the industry care unless there are concerns of violating the law?
If I may respond to that as a practicing lawyer, these statutes offer uncapped attorney's fees on top of any recovery. So there are already actions going on in court to enforce rights, and those rights are enforced. But the plaintiff attorneys are generally proceeding on contingent fees, taking a portion of the recovery, whereas this adds punitive damages and attorney's fees, which then increases the size of the pot enormously, and that increases the fees. This also authorizes class actions, and the class action fees would be very substantial. So the statutes themselves, the way they're drafted, encourage litigation as a profit-making venture for attorneys.
Could we possibly get some comparisons on rates in states so that we could, as a committee, be able to ascertain whether or not there really is a fear that's being put forward?
And I would assume that must be true with all the rest of the industries that fall under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, that in states where Unlawful Trade Practices Act in Oregon regulates all the rest of the industries except for insurance, so our real estate commissions must be a lot higher than Washington's or someplace that doesn't have the Unlawful Trade Practices Act in other industries as well. So, you know, we'll be looking at those rates. I'm asking for a response. We're going to look at those rates in different industries to see, you know, what kind of difference there is from states that have those industries under the UTPA and which states don't. I think that's a good point, Representative Richardson. We'll try to get some research on that. I need to keep moving because now we have limited time left, and I'm going to have to start limiting people to 2 minutes for their testimony. So up next, I have Fred Miller, Jason Skelton, and Wendy Rockholt. And if we can try to keep track of the 2 minutes, Bob, it may be that we don't get through all the testimony today, so we'll have to carry this over. So if there's anybody that cannot come back for another day, which would be Tuesday next week, try to flag that for the committee assistant, please, if you signed up. And go ahead and introduce yourself to the record, please.
Me, sir? Fred Millard. I'm here on behalf of a client of mine by the name of Michael McCohen. Unfortunately, he couldn't be here today as he's tending to business in Hermiston. I am his attorney. My practice is limited primarily to first-party insurance claims, meaning when an insurance company is in dispute with its policyholder, first-party. His written testimony has been submitted for your review, and I certainly don't want to just go over the same thing, but if you'll allow me to give you a brief synopsis of it.
Don't worry. If you can do that in 2 minutes, you bet.
I'm going to do my very best here.
Thank you.
I've been practicing for about, I've been sitting here. In the meantime, Mr. The McCohen family is based out of Merrill, Oregon, which is in the Klamath Basin. They own a packing shed, a potato packing shed, and it was called L&M Produce. It was in the family for three generations. My client, Michael, is the younger Michael. His uncle was Michael. His father is Lee. And they were the second generation, and it was started by my client's grandfather, right after World War II. Merrill's a town of about 800 folks, and in August 2004, there was a fire that just consumed the entire business. Thank you. I'm doing my best here. I've never done this before. Forgive me. The building, the equipment, everything gone. And as a result, although a small business, it was a multi-million-dollar claim. At the time of the fire, Michael was 29 years old. He was the manager of the business. He employed about 47 folks full-time. It was later learned that within 4 days after the fire, the insurance company had decided that this is an arson and that they weren't going to pay the claim. They dragged the McCohens for the next 2 years. They asked for every document under the sun. They kept that a secret. Tax returns, personal information, computer records, you name it, they asked for it. Examinations under oath. Within 1 month of the statute of limitations, they formally denied the claims. I got involved with this claim within days of the statute of limitations, so the first thing I did was file a lawsuit. 7 months after I filed the lawsuit, this is almost 3 years after the fire, Michael McCohen was indicted for arson. It was later learned that the district attorney, the insurance company and its attorneys put tremendous pressure on the local district attorney to indict him for arson, which they did. The local district attorney assigned it to a special prosecutor in Medford who later became a circuit court judge. 18 months after he was indicted, the case was dismissed against him. I later got to talk with the special prosecutor, and he told me that there wasn't enough evidence against this man to try him under any circumstance. Long and behold, Mr. McCohen, his name was dragged. He was never been in trouble in his life, a college graduate.
Are you able to wrap this
up? I'm wrapping it up right now, sir.
Thank you.
A volunteer fireman, a man of the community. His name was dragged through the mud for 5 years and 8 months. Within that time, his family spent in excess of $600,000 criminal lawyers fighting the insurance company. To this day, my client still has nightmares over this, and I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Jason Skelton. I'm a lawyer from Portland, and I'm here with my clients, Wendy Rockholt, and she'll tell you her story.
Hello, thank you and for having me tell my story. About 6 years ago, I was in a car accident. I was rear-ended, and at the time, I didn't really think that I was hurt, you know, because it was my first car, and I was more concerned about my car than I was about my body. And I didn't go to the hospital or anything, but shortly after, my uncle said, well, you should probably get checked out, make sure that you're okay. And so I did, and after I did, the chiropractor told me that I was most likely going to need treatment because we took x-rays of my back and neck, and he said that there was a lot of damage, and so he didn't have an exact, you know, amount of months or how many treatment appointments I would have to come to, but he just said that, you know, he would get back to me in my next appointment, which would be in about 5 days. And in the meantime, there was a farmer's insurance company adjuster that had came out to my house without notice. He just showed up. He didn't have an appointment or anything. And when he showed up, I didn't have anybody at my house with me. I live with my aunt and uncle in Molina, which is kind of in the middle of nowhere. And I usually have somebody with me because I was young and I don't know exactly what's going on. I've never been in a car accident before. And basically, the adjuster came out and without notice, and he proceeded to make me sign a release saying that I would sign my rights away and not get what it was, you know. If I didn't sign the release, then I wasn't going to have my medical paid for, and he wanted to know when my medical was going to be completed and how long it was going to take, and I said, I don't know. I can give you my doctor's card, and he can tell you, you know, what you need to know. Well, he wouldn't take no for an answer and basically wouldn't leave my property until I had signed this paper, and I asked him to reschedule. He refused to and propped his leg up on my chair outside the front, or my front porch, and shoved the clipboard at me and said, I need to sign this if I want my medical paid for. And I was young. I didn't know what my rights were. And so I felt threatened, and I felt like I had to do what I had to do to get my medical paid for because I can't pay for it out of my pocket. So I signed the release. And in conclusion, my point is that I feel like, I mean, I was very much bullied, and I was very much pressured into signing something that I didn't know in legal terms what it meant, and I haven't even found out how long it was going to take as far as treatment goes, you know. I hadn't found out how long it was going to take me to answer his questions, and I never even set up an appointment. You know, he just showed up out of the blue, and it was kind of threatening. I didn't know him. I didn't know if he's really who he says he was, you know. And I think that I think it was wrong. I don't think that it's right for people to be able to do something like that to somebody. I mean, unannounced is not professional at all. And so, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Could you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Jason Skelton.
Do you have testimony?
No, I actually testified briefly. Well, I was Wendy's attorney, okay. And I'm just here with her to introduce her. And
nothing to add to that?
Nothing at all.
All right, thank you. I appreciate that. Up next, I have Neil Jackson, Sarah Jostrom, and David Killian. Good afternoon, and I hate to ask you to try to be concise, and I know it doesn't seem fair maybe, but if you'd introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony, please. Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name's Neil Jackson. I'm actually here. I'm not going to testify. I'm here to introduce Ms. Sorstrom, and tell me how to pronounce it. Shostrom. And Mr. Killian. They're from Astoria, and they're here to tell you their stories about their experience with insurance companies.
Sarah, thank you.
Hi, my name is Sarah Shostrom. In 2009, I went to a midnight showing at the Seaside Coming Attractions Theater. I went up to the concessions and could not predict that I'd fall and blow my knee out and have to end up going to the ER that night, get diagnosed with a blown out knee, and have the insurance agent, Laura Scallion, file a claim that night to start the insurance claim. Have her file the claim and then continue seeking medical assistance as needed to find out a year later that I need surgery while the claim is still open for 2 years. Only having the insurance contact me in the beginning and say, sure, we'll pay, towards the one-year claim is close to ending. I had to call them and physically argue with them verbally to get them to pay me anything to cover the medical bills that had piled up. And then again, the claim was also a one-year and a two-year. Close to the end of the two-year claim, I come to find out that I needed surgery for my knee.
they would not authorize a C-scan. They argue with me that you'd already had an MRI. We can't authorize a C-scan. I felt that she was trying to trip me up to make me slip so that she could use those words and say, okay, well, she's not being honest. We don't have to pay. I had the hospital contacting them on a regular basis, trying to push through so that I could get the surgery done. I was scheduled within 2 months of the claim closing to have the surgery done, but the insurance agency refused to clear it. The only way that I got the surgery done was that the hospital put me on their insurance and went through and did it pro bono anyway. The only way I got anything covered was I had to get a lawyer on the last day of the claim being closed, and the theater had to be served with a subpoena before anything actually happened a couple years later. What? Yeah. Roughly, the medical bills were about $47,100.
$47,000.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. You did just fine. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, members of the committee. My name is David Killian, and I'm here to testify about the behavior of insurance companies and how they treat their customers. 1994, a major storm hit the Oregon coast. We had a major blow off on our roof. The roof system filled full of water. I called my agent. He asked if we can get it patched. Had a contractor. We patched it. He asked for me to get bids. I got bids. The insurance company, which is Valley Insurance, sent down an adjuster. He walked in and he goes, "I'll give you $3,000. Take it or leave it." The bids were at $22,000 because the whole insulation system was full of water. At that point in time, we decided to hire an attorney. We went to legal arbitration. We won. The insurance company appealed it. We proceeded into another winter. We still had blow-offs. We tried to repair it. The contractors at that time would not go onto the roof system. They cut holes in the ceiling. The insulation was wet. There was black mold throughout the house wherever they cut holes. My wife came down with asthma. Whenever the high winds would come up, she would take my daughter and take off and stay at her father's house, scared that the roof system may fall in. As we're waiting for trial, another storm hits and a lot more of the roof went off. Called the contractors back out. We had waters going down into the wall system. We were still paying our insurance, still paying our mortgage. The house was a mess. I mean, it smelled horrible. There were stains everywhere. And, you know, we went to trial. We decided we were going to have to file a second claim. We won the trial. The jury trial, we won that. And then they countersued us and asked for a trial in Clatsop County, and we won that too. And it was 4 years that we lived in a mess. You know, the wife was scared for my daughter, and we couldn't have people over. I mean, or anything. It was a mess. The roof was caving in, and it was over a four-year deal and two jury trials and a legal arbitration before it was finally settled. And I just hope there's a way that you can make insurance companies accountable for these, I don't want to see another family or an individual go through this. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate it, and I know it sounds like you've had a lot of trouble. Thanks for making the trip here to testify today. Up next, I have Catherine Silva Zidell, Kevin Harker, and Don Jacobs. And we can get Lee Mercer to come up too, try to get you in.
Sure.
Lee Mercer is still here. Okay. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, please. Thank you.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Catherine Silva, and I'm general counsel of Zidell Companies based in Portland, Oregon. Zidell Companies are a family-owned group of companies. They've been operating in Portland for approximately the last 100 years. We employ about 260 people, mostly in manufacturing family wage jobs. The Zidell Companies have been pursuing coverage from an insurer on an environmental claim since the mid-1990s. Zidell began the investigatory phase of a DEQ cleanup order in 1995 related to historic contamination at our property. The historic contamination stemmed from many years of industrial activity on the property, as well as Zidell's activity dismantling ships from the mid-1940s through the mid-1970s. In 1994, Zidell received the cleanup notice from the DEQ. We gave notice to our multiple insurers and requested defense and indemnification against the state's cleanup demand. All of our insurers refused to assist in the investigation of the claim and refused to pay defense costs, which were substantial. Zidell was thus forced to incur and pay defense costs and the investigatory expenses itself, and we were forced to file a lawsuit in 1997 for breach of the duty to defend. Some of Zidell's insurers did eventually settle by 2000 on the claim, but one major insurer refused. It continues to litigate this case currently, 19 years after receiving this claim. The case against that insurer did continue to trial, and we did win a judgment, but the insurer immediately turned around and appealed it, and the appeal continues to this date. Last week, the Oregon Court of Appeals issued another order. The case has been remanded back to the Multnomah County Circuit Court for a retrial on a minor issue. Unfortunately, the judge who presided over our original case from 1997 to 2003 has passed away, so we will have to get another judge. Zidell believes that the insurer in this case should have accepted the defense on the claim promptly when it was tendered to them. We believe that the insurer should have settled that claim and paid the indemnity amounts for cleanup costs that we have since paid, which are in excess of $20 million. Although Zidell believes that its insurer has acted in bad faith, has used unfair claim settlement practices, we have been unable to assert any claims or seek any penalties related to that conduct and to those claims handling practices in Oregon over the 19 years that we've been pursuing the claim with this insurer.
Do you have a conclusion?
Yes. If we had been able to assert such claims and seek penalties like that, perhaps that insurer would have been willing to settle this claim. We support, Zidell strongly supports House Bill 3160, and this statutory provision is long overdue as protection for Oregon policyholders. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And also, I understand, I didn't know, but Tatiana Turdell is here as well. And so if you can come up and get your testimony, we have about 10 minutes left. So I got three people left. And the rest of you that have signed up, we're going to carry this over to next Tuesday, and we'll continue this. So, and Ms. Zidell, could you go ahead and sit down and let the next, if you could introduce yourself for the record, please.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Harker. I'm a lawyer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm here on behalf of a client, Zita Nitre, and her mother, who live in Astoria, Oregon, and own an apartment complex there. I'll summarize her written testimony in a minute and 55 seconds. I'll go very fast. They own an apartment complex in Astoria. They hired a contractor in 2004 to perform some extensive remodeling. After the work was done, numerous tenants report water leaks and water coming through windows and sliding glass doors. They hired a professional to investigate the problem. Professional says it was because of this contractor's work that's the cause of this damage and water intrusion. Contractor tenders a claim to the carrier. Carrier refuses to even discuss settlement or discuss coverage, even though on the face of the policy, the exact type of defects and damage that my clients were suffering was covered. They say, we will do nothing unless you file a lawsuit. They file a lawsuit in Clatsop County. On the eve of trial, carrier offers 10% of the repair costs, and ultimately a jury awarded my clients $140,000. Rather than paying the judgment, they refuse and file an appeal. through the appeal process, ultimately my clients decided to settle for less than what they were awarded by the jury because they wanted to be done with it. But Ms. Nitre's case, I think, illustrates an example of an insurance carrier selling a policy, not honoring the coverage that's in that policy, acting in bad faith, and ultimately hurting an Oregon consumer. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that concise testimony. If you'd introduce yourself.
I'm Don Jacobs, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm a lawyer from Vancouver, Washington, and I've been practicing for 33 years. Even though I practice in Vancouver, I also have an office in Portland, and my practice consists of doing insurance law disputes. People hire me when they have disputes with their auto insurance company, with their homeowners company, with small business insurance, and I sure hope you can get some numbers on the rates between the two states, because my experience has been just the opposite from what we've heard here so far. Between my clients and my own personal rates in Washington have not gone up. We had this 2007 law in Washington, the Insurance Fair Conduct Act, which was passed by the legislature in 2007. The insurance industry didn't care for it. They got enough signatures to put it up for an initiative battle. In 2008, the voters rejected them and passed it by some significant margins. And since that time, even though we heard stuff in that campaign that carriers would be leaving the state, insurance premiums would skyrocket, I haven't seen any of those things happen over in Washington. So I hope you can get some real numbers on that that really compare to see if our rates are any different, because my personal experience is they're not. Just briefly, that law over there allows a first-party insured, a customer of the insurance company only, to, if they think their claim has been unreasonably denied, to give the insurance company 30 days' notice, and if they still refuse to pay it, then if they file a lawsuit and they can prove it was unreasonably denied, they not only get the claim paid, but they get their lawyer fees reimbursed to them, their court costs, and if the judge feels it was truly unreasonably denied, the judge in her or his discretion can triple the size of the claim. And I have found that it's been much easier helping consumers in Washington with these insurance disputes ever since that law. So I'm speaking in favor of this as well. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that testimony. Ms. Tirdal?
Tirdal.
If you could introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony, please.
Yes. Hi, my name is Tatiana Tirdal. Thank you very much for letting me testify. I can't come on Tuesday. It's a bit a lot of juggling of kids' schedules to do that. So I'm testifying in support of HB 2525 and HB 3616 as a parent who has been trying to access services for autism for years now and have encountered many illegal denials of care and illegal contract provisions that have had detrimental effect on my kids' health. There is a written testimony from my husband who has been in those years developed expertise and has helped over 80 families access care for autism. He's now an expert on the denials and on all the legal matters relating to this coverage. So I would encourage you to read his testimony. What I can say is that when our first child was diagnosed in 2008 by our insurance, Kaiser, we were given a sheet of paper stating that they don't provide any coverage for autism and that we should go for any services for autism to the state, to our county. As we later found, that was actually illegal because they were already legally obligated to cover services for autism and not dump everybody on the state. So my son, my oldest son, started getting his ABA therapy only 2 years after his diagnosis, and it definitely affected, we lost a lot of time, and it definitely affected the level of improvement that he had. With my youngest son, we were already more experienced. We started therapy quickly and intensively and just started paying it for it
ourselves and then started doing the appeals with the insurance division, just hoping for reimbursement later. And he's made tremendous progress. So he'll be starting in kindergarten in the fall, and he would likely receive only minimal services. Definitely would not need a one-on-one aid. So my oldest son, who is a TAG student, who tested in 99th percentile in reading, math, and intellectual ability, has a one-on-one aid in gen ed classroom and may actually need private placement. My youngest son, who received early intensive therapy, has the same high IQ, has made very good progress with his early therapy and would not need any of those very costly state funds from the state. We are not the only family in the case where we've had to deal with many denials and had to go to insurance division to overturn them. As I said, my husband has helped over 80 families to access care, and currently in the public school system, there are 8,500 kids with autism receiving different types of services from the state. Services that could have been lower, or there would not be as much need for services if they actually received proper care early, just at the time of diagnosis.
And can you make your conclusion, please?
Yes. So what I want to say, out of those 8,000 kids, so far only one family has been able to bring lawsuit for denial of care, and that's one Mark Henry family, partly because they were able to put a retainer of over $50,000, because as my husband, you know, as they found and as other families found, the Oregon's insurance code is virtually unenforceable for consumers. There is no private right of action for violations of the Oregon insurance code. Any consumer litigation must be under federal law or it's breach of contract. Breach of contract suits can't recover attorney's fees and are based on the language of the contract itself, even if that contract is out of compliance with the insurance code. Legal fees in a complex case can easily exceed $100,000, making it impossible for the average consumer to afford justice. So if you wanted to bring a suit right now from against your insurance company, medical insurance, you will have to give an attorney a retainer of $50,000, and there's just no way for many consumers to do that. So as a and in conclusion, I want to state that currently the way the law is set up, and because the insurance industry is exempt from the Unfair Trade Practices Act, there is a moral hazard because they don't feel like they have to obey the laws and regulations that they don't like to, partly because they feel there is very little chance of enforcement. Consumers can't really enforce the rules. It's too expensive, prohibitively expensive. And so far, our dealings with the insurance division show that they would help on case-by-case basis, but in bigger violations, systematic violations, like denial for any autism services or developmental disabilities, they have not fixed the problem for the entire class of consumers that are affected.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I don't know. We have just a couple minutes. Is there somebody else that needs to testify? Come on up. I'll give you about 1 minute, and I know that doesn't seem fair.
Maybe one and a half.
So, Chair Holvey and committee members, my name is Lee Mercer, and I'm with the Main Street Alliance of Oregon. We're a statewide network of small businesses, about 1,200 in our network now. One of our key areas of concern is health care. We've been advocating on the Affordable Care Act and on Cover Oregon, and one of our members is on the board of Cover Oregon and another on the Consumer Advisory Committee. This interest in controlling costs on health care and so forth has led us into this realm about bills dealing with the insurance company. Last month, we sent out an email poll on some other bills to our statewide leadership group. We have about 60 small businesses around the state in this group. And we asked if they would support or oppose a bill to give the Attorney General the power to sue insurance companies that engage in fraud, noting that this is the only line of business exempt from the state's Unfair Practices Act. Of those responding, 96% would support such a bill. We don't see this consensus across the state very often among our leadership group. We are in support of HB 3160. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I assume you have testimony to turn in.
Yes.
We already had it. Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Trey Coode. I'm an attorney from Hillsborough. I'm a past president of the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel. The OADC is a group of about 700 attorneys who defend people in civil lawsuits. We also represent businesses in litigation with one another. I'm here to oppose the bill as drafted, and I'd like to just give you two reasons for
which one?
3160, HB 3160, and it kind of follows through because they're, 2525, 3160 kind of follows through from this. And the reason is, as drafted, the language of the bill would leave open at least some argument by creative attorneys that somehow defense attorneys would be potentially liable under this bill. And that is because of the statutes that it seeks to modify include the term insurance companies and others. And it's that for that reason that we would oppose the bill as it is drafted. We'd be happy to work with the proponents or anybody else to work on that language. The other aspect has to do with fairness of the bill, just in terms of fundamental fairness in trying to litigate cases. And that is the attorney's fees provisions are not simply reciprocal, but impose a burden greater on the defendant in a case who prevails, to the extent that a defendant in all actuality is never going to get attorney's fees if they prevail in these kind of claims. The statute as it's written really would be a leverage statute. Now, the Supreme Court has said we recognize that there are statutes out there. ORS 2080, which is a small claim statute, says prevailing plaintiffs get attorney's fees. There's a cap on those damages, and that's a $10,000 cap. Under this type of statute, and the way that this is worded, there wouldn't be any limit on the amount of damages that somebody could recover under this sort of a leveraged circumstance. Anyway, the imposition of, or the argument that a defense attorney might be liable under these circumstances creates real problems. In the past, when these issues have come up before, we've been able to work with folks to amend that language. I hope that we could do so again in this circumstance, and we'd be happy to do that. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, and we'll take your testimony, keep your name, and probably contact you.
Great. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, committee. We're behind schedule. If you can make sure we clean our desks off to help the staff out a little bit. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3160 and House Bill 2525 and adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency.